Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
We want to continue tonight the study that we've been having on Sunday evenings, and I think it's a profitable one, and I'd appreciate your input into it, in studying the Bible book by book. We are tonight still in the Old Testament and in the period of the history of the Israelite nation, the book of 1 Samuel. I think that this is profitable for us because we often sing the song, "I love to tell the story. Tell me the old, old story." Different songs that we sing. And how can we really do that if we don't know the story? And the Bible is an account from beginning to end of God's plan for redeeming man. And when you study any portion of the Word of God, it is to your advantage to have knowledge as to where that particular book fits in all of God's revelation of that system by which He saves men through Christ. And of course, the Bible student knows that the nation through which the Lord was to come was the nation of Israel. And there are 12 books in the Old Testament that are attributed to be books of history, not exclusively history, but a great deal of history that tells the adventures of that nation as we continue to see God unfolding and unrolling and manifesting and making known His plan for bringing about our salvation. Tonight we look at the book called 1 Samuel. In the Hebrew Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel were really one book. In fact, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings were called the Book of Kings because that's where we read about all of the kings of Israel. This particular book covers the period of Israel's history from the time of Samson, which was the last judge discussed in the book of Judges. And then 1 Samuel includes the last two judges, Eli and Samuel. The transition from God ruling Israel by judges to the establishment of a kingdom. And then this book also includes the life, career, and the death of the first king, King Saul. And in revealing to us that portion of history, we are introduced to the early days of the career of David. So this book really continues where Judges ended. And the main characters of the book are Eli and Samuel, the last two judges, Saul and David. There are some other characters with which the Bible student is very familiar and held in high esteem in this book, such as Hannah, the mother of Samuel, Jonathan, the friend of David, and many others. Well, the book opens with a prayer on the part of Hannah for a son. She had been barren. She prayed for a son. And she became the mother of Samuel. And in this book, we read of the early life of Samuel. I'd just like to make point here that Hannah made a promise that if God would give her a son, it was a promise that it seems to me every mother and every father should make concerning every son and every daughter. She said, "I will give him unto the Lord." I don't know about you, but I think that's a powerful commitment. That's a tremendous purpose, isn't it? Can you think of parenthood in a higher, more noble situation than being grateful to God for a child and then promising, "I will give him unto the Lord"? The word Samuel means ask of God. And Samuel, according to the promise that Hannah had made, was brought at an early age to the place of Shiloh, the place of the tabernacle, where he was to be trained as a public servant of the people and of God, and where he was to be molded, where he would be an effective leader of God's people. And he was trained under the guidance of a man named Eli, the next to the last judge. The time of the birth of Samuel, however, was a time when the spiritual level of Israel was at a very low ebb. And when Samuel was very young, God called him, and Samuel responded in a most magnificent way. His response was, ultimately, after he first thought Eli had called him, he realized that it was not Eli calling him. Finally, he was informed by Eli, God is calling him. He responded in this way, "Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth." What an example for me and for you. What a marvelous attitude of submission and obedience and reverence. "Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth." And it was at that time that Samuel was told by the Almighty of the impending judgment and disasters that were soon to befall the house of Eli. Having told us of Hannah and Samuel's birth and his early commitment to the Lord and so forth, the story then at that point sort of reverts back a little bit to focus upon Eli. And as one studies the life story of Eli, he has mixed emotions about him. And there is something about him that provokes sadness, particularly with the tragedy regarding his sons. It seems that as one looks at the life of Eli, that Eli was a very faithful man, a humble man, a man who did his best, it seems, to faithfully discharge his responsibilities to Israel and to God, but he failed and failed miserably to rear his sons to be righteous. And the Bible says that he restrained them not. It just simply seems that Eli had these sons and he just more or less let them set their own pace and go their own way and do their own thing. And when they did wrong, he did not exercise his authority to keep them in line. And as a result, their lives, they brought reproach upon Eli. They brought reproach upon Israel. They brought reproach upon God before the enemies of Israel. And in a battle between Israel and the Philistines, these two sons, as well as others, took the Ark of the Covenant, this most holy and sacred piece of furniture that was to be in the most holy place of the tabernacle. They took it out of its designated place, and they took it into battle, thinking that having that sacred piece of furniture in battle, that surely God would be with them and all would be well and they would be victorious simply because of the presence of the ark. We learn some lessons from all of this. God was highly displeased at their misuse of that which was sacred. Really, they were using this Ark of the Covenant, I suppose, like, well, maybe it's somewhat like a lucky charm or something like that that we might think of. This was not the purpose of it. It wasn't to defend Israel in their battles. And that which resulted was a day of darkness for the people of Israel. Israel was defeated. Eli's sons were killed. The ark was captured by the Philistines. And when the news was told to Eli, having learned then that the ark was captured, he was an elderly man and had already lost his eyesight and a heavy man, he fell backward, broke his neck, and died. That's a very sad ending, isn't it? To a man that certainly made some grave mistakes pertaining to his son, but a man that had striven personally to try to be faithful to God. Well, once the ark was captured by the Philistines, they took it into Philistia, their country, but it wrought havoc among the Philistines. It wrought havoc with Dagon, their false idol god. It wrought havoc upon them physically because the people were smitten with tumors. And after they moved it from city to city to city, they finally decided we need to send this thing back. And so they sent it back into Israel. With the death of Eli, Samuel becomes the leader of Israel. And he goes to the place called Ramah. Ramah seems to have been the home. And I suppose if we would say that Samuel had a place of headquarters, this would probably be it. You know, it's a tragic thing about Samuel. He's certainly one of the greatest of all the Israelites, but he failed to learn regarding Eli and his sons, because the sons of Samuel were also very wicked men. But Samuel himself was a most exceptional religious leader. And throughout his career, he was successful in raising this low spiritual ebb that was current when he was born. And he raised his nation. And he brought peace to this nation. And there was a time when once the Philistines attacked the Israelites, and Samuel called upon God for deliverance. And God did spare them and cause the Philistines to flee. And Samuel raised a rock. And he called that rock Ebenezer. And the word Ebenezer simply means God hath helped us. In one of our songs, I don't know whether it's in our songbook or not, I forget, but the verse says, "Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I've come. O thy fount of every blessing," by the way, is the song. If we happen to have it, we might sing it tonight at the close. I'm not trying to tell you what to do unless I can get away with it, but that'd be a good song to sing. "Here I raise my Ebenezer, You know, sometimes we might sing words and we don't really grasp what it is, but that's what it means. Hither by thy help I've come. Every single one of us, we have our personal Ebenezer, friend. We are where we are by the providence and the grace of God. We're so blessed because God hath helped us. Samuel was such a good man and he did such a good job, but Israel became restless with being judged by judges and they wanted a king and they offered all manner of excuses as to why they wanted a king, but finally the real reason came out. They wanted to be like the nations round about them. They weren't content to be that unique, special nation that God desired them to be. And this grieved Samuel, but God comforted him by saying, Samuel, their desire for a king and you no longer being judge, it was not a rejection of Samuel, it was a rejection of God. So Samuel was told to go and to anoint Saul of the tribe of Benjamin as the first king. We need to understand that when people reject the people of God, they're not just rejecting the people of God. When the people of God are standing for the things of God and are rejected, who is it that's really being rejected? It's God that's being rejected, isn't it? And this is what the Israelites were doing. They were desiring to have a governmental system that was likened unto the heathen pagan nations around them rather than the way that God had ruled them for nearly four centuries since they conquered the land of Canaan. And they were rejecting God. But now our attention is focused upon this first king, King Saul. And you know, Saul at the beginning appeared to have every advantage, every opportunity and every desirable quality that a person could want in order to be the king over this special nation. And he began so well. We're not going to review in detail the actions of Saul at the beginning nor toward the end, but his very first actions, if you go back and take the time to read of Saul in 1 Samuel, you cannot help but be impressed that it manifested on his part a great faith in God. He was a man of tremendous courage. And unlike so many times those who are in places of responsibility of a nation, this man possessed genuine humility, and he demonstrated exceptional wisdom. He was just about everything that anybody could have ever desired to have assumed the lead of this nation. And further than that, when things went so well, he always, at the first, gave credit to God, not to himself, but to God. And Samuel, now no longer the leader of the people, you would think that he might have slipped off into retirement and maybe a little bit bitter because he had been rejected, but that wasn't his attitude. In 1 Samuel chapter 12, we read in verse 23 Samuel's expressions of what he would continue to do and did do. He said, "Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way." Samuel, you're no longer the judge. People don't come to you. You're not the leader of the people. Well, I know that. You've asked for a king. God's given you a king. But I'm not going to sin against God. How does he figure he'd be sinning against God? If he didn't do for the people what ought to have been done, he looked upon it as being neglect of his duty before God. And he said, "I'm going to continue to pray, and I'm going to continue to teach, and I'm going to teach you the good way and the right way." And this is that which he did through the remaining of his life. Brethren, when you study the Bible, there are very few, if any, men that could come to the end of a long life, public service, always in the spotlight, having lived in a glass house, so to speak, all of his days since childhood. And he comes to the end of his career as unmarred and unscarred as anybody of whom you could ever read. And he even challenged the people, "If I have done anybody any injustice, if I have mistreated anybody, please name it. We're going to get it straight." And nobody brought a single charge against him. Now, isn't that absolutely astounding? After a lifelong service, how many of the leaders of our own nation could go 4 years or 8 years without almost being hounded to death? And maybe with some justification. But this man spent his whole life in such a way that nobody raised any accusation against him whatsoever. He has to rank high as one of God's noble men. Well, it seems as the career of Saul progressed, He seemed to have lost every manly and commendable trait that he had at the beginning of his life. And now his career becomes laced and spotted with all kinds of transgressions and glaring acts of presumption and disobedience. He had many wars with their enemies round about. He offered sacrifices as if he were a priest, doing so without authority. He developed within himself, the Bible teaches, an evil heart. He even went so far as to take it upon himself to slay or have slain some of the priests of God. In the latter few days of his life, he even communed with witches, which was even against his own law. And as one reads of this certain decline of Saul in his spirituality, in his conduct, in his disposition, in his manner of rule, God instructed Samuel to go and to anoint David to be the next king. Probably the most notable blunder of God regarding Saul was that with relationship to the Amalekites. Now, the Amalekites had attacked Israel after they had once crossed the Red Sea, and God told them then they would be destroyed, and God told Israel, told Moses, they'd be punished for it. And God instructed Samuel to go and to utterly destroy the Amalekites and all their possessions. And Samuel went down among the Amalekites, and there is no question he wrought a great victory over the Amalekites, and he subdued them. But he did not obey what God said. Many of the Amalekites escaped, were allowed to escape. King Agag, bless your heart. King Agag, he spared him. And many of the flocks and the herds of the Amalekites he spared. And he had all kind of excuses. Oh, the people wanted it. Well, that wasn't what he's told him to do. Go down there and then ask the people what you think you ought to do. God told him what to do. He said, oh, we brought all this back so we could sacrifice unto you. And then what God told him to do, he told him to destroy those things. And when he came back, Samuel asked him, have you obeyed the voice of the Lord? Oh, yeah, I've obeyed the voice of the Lord. He says, well, now, if that's the truth, what's all these noise, this noise I hear from all these animals? Where'd they come from? Oh, and then here comes his excuses as to why he did all of that. And then that's when Samuel told him, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Oh, my beloved, hear me well. Here is one of the great principles of God's revelation, even to me and to you. We've come here tonight, as we do regularly and biblically, to worship God, to do the things that God has ordained and authorized that we do in worship. But there is something that must precede our worship for it to be acceptable before God. You know what that is? That's a righteous life of obedience. How inconsistent for one to live his own way and live like the devil during the week and then think he can come into the church services on Sunday and go through the rituals, and that's what they are, the ceremonies, the actions, the authorized actions of worship, and all is well, and then go on back to his manner of life. That won't get it, brethren. Even the prayer of a wicked man is an abomination before God. To live lives that are inconsistent with the way that God has called upon us to live and then to go through the forms of worship, it's mockery. Now, this does not in any way minimize the necessity and the power and the privilege of worship. You hear people say, oh, it doesn't make any difference where you go to church. It's how you live. Now, that's a most inconsistent statement. It's not an either-or situation. It does matter how you live. It also matters how you worship. It takes both. But your worship is not acceptable if your manner of life is not consistent with the faith of Jesus Christ. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. One of the great sins of Saul was that of when he became what we would characterize as being insanely jealous of one of his greatest assets. And that was young David. In this book we read of the early life of David. In the latter days of Saul's reign, David soared to great national prominence in Israel. He jumped from a shepherd lad to a national hero just overnight when he accomplished that great event, which we're all familiar, when he slew the giant Goliath of the Philistines. Well, this deed on the part of David caused the people to sing a song that said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul became jealous of that. He could not accept the greatness of David. He could not see how David was one of the greatest tools that he had in his kingdom, that he could help Israel so much and could utilize them. He just could not bear to have one of his subordinates receive praise that surpassed the praise that he received himself. And therefore, rather than using David properly, as he could have and should have, he sought David's life. And David became a fugitive in his own land and was oftentimes run out of his land, had to escape time and time for his own life. And 1 Samuel tells us of many of the threatening situations in David's life as he was sought by Saul. And it was in this context that we read of this great friendship that developed between Jonathan, Saul's son, and David. And they remained true and loyal friends to the very end of Jonathan's life. One thing that we do read and with which we are impressed, revealed here in 1 Samuel about David, was his remarkable attitude of non-retaliation toward Saul, who sought to kill him. In spite of the fact that Saul wanted to destroy him, he had great respect for Saul. And the reason was, he said, he is the Lord's anointed. And I am personally feel that surely this kind of attitude, the respect for that which God had appointed, contributed to David being called a man after God's own heart. And David served Israel well. He served Saul well, not only regarding Goliath, but as a musician to try to comfort Saul, as a leader of Saul's armies in the battle, and he even served well as a fugitive. And he often had the opportunity to destroy Saul, but as I said, he would not raise his hand against him. The last portion of Saul's life, which is in this book, was a sad time for Saul, a troublesome time for him, but it was also a very trying time for David, especially after David had been anointed to be the next king. Because he was constantly in flight, he was a victim of betrayal, he lived through trying circumstances. And also in the midst of all of this, that great and wonderful man Samuel died. I think it is interesting to take note that Samuel had been such a noble, stabilizing influence throughout all of the transition from the judges to the kings. He was that great elder statesman. He was the one to whom everybody could turn for advice. And the very two men that he had anointed to be king over Israel were at odds with one another at Samuel's death, one of them trying to kill the other one. 1 Samuel closes with a tragic report of Saul's death. Israel was threatened once again by the Philistines, and Saul was concerned over what might transpire. And so he consorted with the witch of Endor, and in that encounter he was told of an impending defeat, the death of his sons and his own death. And sure enough, the next day Israel was defeated. Saul's sons, the ones that were in battle, including Jonathan, were killed. Saul was wounded. He asked for one standing by to slay him. The one standing by would not, and so he fell upon his own sword, taking his own life. You know, I think we have to describe the career of the first king as a real fiasco. It was tragic. Starting so well, to end with such collapse and failure. But 1 Samuel, though it closes on that dark note, leads us to believe, and we certainly become aware of it, that better things were in store for Israel. How often it is true. You've seen it in your own life. Seems like sometimes it's the darkest just before the light. And this was a dark time for Israel, the time of the Philistines defeating Israel and Saul taking his own life. But now the stage was set for that most exceptional rule and reign by David. And when David becomes king, he first becomes king over Judah, the southern part. Later on, he gradually establishes his power over all the 12 tribes of Israel. He was already prominent. It was just a matter of working it out according to God's time. And as the book closes, David becomes king, and the record of his career as king continues on in 2 Samuel. Now, close with this observation. Cannot you see how that this book of 1 Samuel, like the other books that we have studied, are still pointing to something down the way, isn't it? It is still an unfolding of that great and grand fulfillment of a promise that God had made all the way back here to Abraham, that in thy seed shall all the families of the earth would be blessed. All of this book here is still pointing toward the coming of Christ. And we now become involved in the next book with a very prominent physical, fleshly ancestor of Jesus, who was David, whose kingdom, David's kingdom, serves as a type, a pre-picture of the spiritual kingdom that the Son of David, Jesus Christ, was going to establish when he came to this earth, which he did. And so we're still following through the history of Israel. And as we study this book, we see right where it fits, don't we? Right here, it provides for us a very important piece in the puzzle, if we wish to speak of it in that way, of how God plans to save me and save you through that Son that was promised, the Messiah that was to come. I think we can all lift our hearts in true and genuine thanksgiving to God that He's seeing fit to tell us and to show us the working of His will, His plan, His principles, His truths, even back in those days from many, many years ago, and told us in this wonderful book of 1 Samuel and the wonderful characters and their lives that are revealed in it. Such will be the lesson for tonight, Lord willing, while we'll take up the next book the next time. But if you're here tonight, you need to take advantage of what God has provided through Christ, and there's only one way to do that, and that is for you to come to Christ, and there's only one way to do that, and that's by rendering obedience to the gospel plan of salvation. Faith in Christ, repentance of sins, confession of that faith, baptism into Christ, where we reach His blood and are washed clean, added to God's kingdom, His church, be God's people, to live and to labor in this life as faithful children of God with the hope, the promise, and the assurance that should we do these things, heaven will be our home. Have you taken advantage of what God has provided?